So now we want to talk a little bit about toxicity, particularly as it relates to the consolidation part of therapy. And actually, it turns out to be a pretty interesting discussion as it plays out in practice. Actually, probably more interesting as it plays out in the cases and when you look at the data, because there's a lot of granularity about trying to figure out what's going on. And I think you're going to see that in these cases. But first, another question. Just kind of curious to the audience. So you have a 75-year-old patient who has metastatic, non-small cell, for example, PD-L1 levels high, so they're going to get pembrolizumab. So my question to you is, how often are you going to give it? You're going to give it every 3 weeks, or are you going to give it every 6 weeks? And while we're waiting to see what their answer, Beth, just kind of curious, we now have seen the approval of a Q6 weeks pembrolizumab. How's that affected your practice, Beth? It looks like, in terms of the audience, about a third have converted over. Not everybody's necessarily sold that every single patient should get this. What's going on at Penn in that regard, Beth?
I originally thought every 6 weeks, woohoo, they don't have to come in as often and fight traffic, though with COVID, there's not a lot of traffic anymore. But I've found that I'm not using it every 6 weeks as much as I thought I would. Just to be clear, this is the metastatic setting we're talking about, not locally advanced. But in that metastatic setting for stage 4 lung cancer patients, a lot of them, even though they tolerate single agent pembrolizumab very well, they have a lot of other issues that a lot of times I don't feel comfortable waiting 6 weeks to follow up on. Like maybe there's questionable LFTs and I want to check up on them. One guy I thought for sure I was going to start every 6 weeks and he's having post brain radiation issues. And I didn't feel like I should wait 6 weeks to see him. So I would agree. I would probably say only about a quarter of my patients have I kind of converted to that every 6 weeks. The majority of them, I'm still keeping it every 3 weeks because I just feel they have those symptomatic needs that need to be followed up on.
And Liz, I'm curious what's going on at MD Anderson in that regard. I have heard lung cancer investigators saying, kind of like what Beth was saying, particularly when somebody gets started on therapy, they like to see them more frequently. But of course, you can still see the patient, even by telemedicine if you want to, differently, and whether or not they're going to get an infusion. But I am curious, Liz, what's going on at MD Anderson in terms of Q3 or 6 weeks pembrolizumab?
I think many of our patients are still on the Q3-week pembrolizumab. I think we've just started very slowly switching to Q6 weeks, and that's for patients who are really doing well. I agree with Beth. I think 6 weeks is a long time in between visits, whether in person or telemedicine, and yes, we can do an earlier visit. But some of our patients travel in from 1 to 2 hours away, and so to come in for telemedicine or for a phone call, they want to get treatment the same day. So we're still on the Q3-week schedule. I think we will slowly evolve to a Q6-week, but it's going to be a very precise patient with minimal toxicities who can go 6 weeks.
So Stephen, what about consolidation durvalumab? Can that, every single tumor type now has papers coming out about how you change, intervals between treatment and imaging, et cetera. What about consolidation durvalumab? Can you stretch that out?
You can in certain instances, I think. It's given every 2 weeks at a dose of 10 mgs per kg, but there is an approved dosing of durvalumab that is longer. In the Caspian trial, which was the approval for small cell lung cancer, durvalumab was given every 4 weeks. And so you could ask for that regimen to be approved. We've had success with that with certain private insurers. With Medicare, that would still be off-label in the stage 3, and so that would be not reimbursed. But for private insurance, if you get prior authorization, yes, you could potentially use that FDA-approved small cell Q4-week regimen if that were the case.
Interesting. Well, let's go back to a case and, again, start to see how this plays out. And we're about to hear about a couple cases where things didn't go as smoothly, and you'll see the challenge in trying to figure out what's going on, not only with the treatment, but even issues such as COVID. What happened with this 81-year-old lady, Liz?
This is my traveler, and she was diagnosed in late 2018 when she presented with weakness, shortness of breath, and weight loss. Found to have a T1AN2 adenocarcinoma of the lung. Again, no driver mutations. And she went on concurrent chemoradiation with weekly carboplatin paclitaxel, followed by maintenance durvalumab. And she just about finished a year of maintenance durvalumab when we did a PET CT in January 2020. And she had multiple new bilateral pulmonary nodules, which our radiologists were reading as possible metastatic disease. So the durvalumab was held, and we proceeded to biopsy one of the larger left lung nodules, and it was benign. It was lung parenchyma with features of organizing pneumonia, no evidence of malignancy. These are her baseline findings, and you can see where the hotspot is on my right. And she really had a nice response. We didn't have subsequent PET CT, so it's a little hard to see. But in the CT, you can see the pulmonary nodules, and they turned out to be benign parenchyma. And based on the biopsy result, she went traveling very safely due to COVID-19, but she went traveling just to get out of Houston and a little downtime and take a break.
Well, you didn't mention the type of travel.
Cruise, and she was fine. But
now this was January, right?
Yeah.
Because I think our sensitivity about travel maybe has increased over the last 6 months, but definitely. It was kind of interesting in terms of that. Any comments, Stephen, about this case? And you know, it's both of these cases. It was kind of challenging to figure out what's going on. I'm sure this lady was terrified when she heard about that scan and tremendously relieved when she heard about the biopsy. Is this a common situation, Stephen?
Not common, but it's important to detect when we do it. And kudos to Liz and her team for really doing this the right way. You could easily see a situation where this patient would have been diagnosed with relapse, given docetaxel-based chemotherapy, the next scan looks great, and you'd be patting yourself on the back. And really, it was just a flare of immune toxicity that was going to get better on its own. This is particularly important when we're talking here in about a year or two, when we're doing a lot of neoadjuvant immunotherapy. When you use immunotherapy, sometimes we see these PET-avid flares, these nodal flares, and it's important we don't assume that that's disease, we don't assume that that's progression. A lot of times those are benign flares, really related to T cells localizing in different places, and we don't have to assume that the treatment's not working.
So you kind of slipped in an interesting, I'll call it prediction, actually, in saying about neoadjuvant therapy. You think that's where things are heading?
100%. Yeah.
Really?
You know, from a scientific basis, I really think that our immune system is going to work against those tumors better with them in place. So in the adjuvant setting after surgery, immunotherapy is being studied, but I think neoadjuvant is going to be generating those long-term responses. We're going to cure more of these surgical patients, seeing very exciting responses, but you can see these flares. And when we see these flares, we know now I have to go in, biopsy, and make sure that that's actually disease, because a lot of times it's not. And a lot of times those are the people that are getting the most benefit. And that's work done primarily out of the institutions from the other three panelists.
Yeah, that's true. And Ben, you know, one of the things that's been interesting about neoadjuvant therapy, of course, here we're saying, okay, a patient presents with lung cancer, they're untreated, and the first thing they get is a therapy that includes a checkpoint inhibitor. And one of the things that's been interesting when this has been looked at, Ben, is then a lot of these, in some of these trials, the patients then went to surgery, and on imaging, they actually had stuff to see, so to speak. And yet when they went in, what they found was necrotic tissue. Yeah. Any comments on that, Ben? And do you agree with Stephen that this is kind of maybe where we're going to be heading? I mean, breast cancer, it was the first meeting we did here. And we talked about triple negative, HER2 positive, standard of care. These people almost always get neoadjuvant therapy, Ben. Do you think that's where we're heading with lung cancer?
Yeah, I think that we are seeing in multiple studies that starting with, rather than going to surgery right away, starting with either immunotherapy or chemotherapy with immunotherapy or dual checkpoint blockade, that there's a real complete pathological response or a major pathological response. And so, you know, you're getting less than 10% viable tumor cells when you take out the tumor on surgery. And I think we realize that a major pathological response correlates to better outcomes. So I think that this is real. I think that the challenge that I still see in our own institution, which is a big neoadjuvant institution, is getting the surgeons on board sometimes. Oftentimes, patients come in, and if they have a surgically resectable cancer, you know, the surgeons are off, you know, we need to motivate them to remember to refer them to the medical oncologist so that we can deliver these therapies, because I do think that these window, I call them window of opportunity trials, where you have a biopsy and then a surgical specimen, and you're wedging in there some sort of immunotherapy prior to surgery, is where we're going to be moving. And I wouldn't be surprised if we don't see an approval for neoadjuvant immunotherapy in the next 6 to 12 months for surgically resectable disease.
But I think that's going to be a tough sell to the patient too, to be truthful. I mean, I see these patients come in and they're like, I want it out as fast as possible. And so to say, well, we'd like to give you these drugs first and they may or may not make you sick. I mean, I hear you. It's a tough sell to the, you know, the surgeon sometimes, but I think the patient too, they hear surgery, they want it out.
Sounds like it might be a tough sell for you, Beth, but I guess if we see the data and these people do better, then yeah, I guess we'll follow it. I would imagine that we would follow it. Stephen, you know, another issue is, and again, in other cancers, bladder cancer also, we're going to talk about it. By doing neoadjuvant, you get a chance to look at what's going on, you know, biologically. You look at the cancer after they take it out, see what happened biologically, what predicts benefit. It's maybe a way to move the field forward, Stephen. Any thoughts?
From a scientific standpoint, you're absolutely right. We call that a window of opportunity trial, where now I get a big chunk of tissue and see exactly what's happened. Did we do anything with it? In the adjuvant setting, when everything that we can see is already gone, we don't know if our treatments are actually doing anything or if they're needed to do anything. And I 100% agree with Beth that patients are often pushing for surgery. What I think has been smart by this research effort in the neoadjuvant setting is that a lot of these trials are really being run and led by surgeons. And the surgeons are really the proponents, are really advocating for this because we want better outcomes. You know, surgery for a stage 2, a stage 3 lung cancer, most patients are going to recur. Our numbers are not like other cancers. And, you know, Ben and I are really on the same page. And I hope Ben knows that they're recording this, you know, that we're on that we're on record as, yeah, as being on the same page. Usually we're kind of at odds. We have to settle it on the basketball court. But
you guys play basketball?
Oh, yeah, all the time.
Oh, yeah. Oh, really? We have to play a little bit. I got a court right out in my front yard here. It's the only way I can play nowadays. Anyhow, let's get back to the Pacific trial. And, you know, pardon us for going off on tangents, but, you know, that's what rounds is all about. Let's get back to the Pacific trial, Ben. And maybe you can talk a little bit about what was seen in terms of toxicity. We know that checkpoint inhibitors occasionally can cause pneumonitis. Yeah. We know that radiation therapy is going to cause pneumonitis wherever you radiate in the lung. So there were a lot of concerns before this trial that maybe there was going to be a lot of problems in the lung, and kind of seems like that maybe that didn't really happen. But can you go through what was seen, Ben?
Yeah, I think in terms of pneumonitis, I think roughly a third of patients in the Durva arm had any grade pneumonitis compared to about 25% in the control arm that had any grade pneumonitis. But overall, obviously, there was more immune toxicity with the durvalumab arm versus the control. There was a discontinuation due to adverse events in 15% of patients in the Durva arm versus 10% in the placebo arm. I would say, you know, we can talk about these paper toxicities and what we saw in the trial, but it probably more important with what I see, because we've seen a lot of patients treated with Durva. And the bottom line is the drug is reasonably well tolerated. We don't see a lot of pneumonitis. When we do, most of the time it is grade 1 or 2. We hold the drug. We often treat with steroids and then resume depending on the grade. We do see, as I think Stephen mentioned earlier, we do see hypothyroidism with these agents, and we see fatigue. But that's been my experience. The drug has been a welcome change because it is, as Stephen mentioned earlier, this is not an easy, concurrent chemoradiation is one of the more difficult strategies to deliver in all of solid tumor malignancy. And to be able to give a drug safely for up to a year after that, and again, yes, there is a risk of pneumonitis that we see. Yes, there's hypothyroidism. Yes, there's fatigue. You know, overall, my experience has been this drug is reasonably well tolerated. Can I get most patients to a year? You know, I would say probably 60 to 70% of my patients make it to 12 months, 30 to 40%. We have to stop for some reason. So, you know, I think it's a welcome change and a reasonably well tolerated agent that's active and provides a survival advantage post concurrent chemo radiation.
But, you know, what a challenge when you have a therapy, chemo radiation therapy, that, you know, you all describe as having a lot of issues, a lot of tolerability, and now you layer something on top of it, and you're trying to figure out by layering on this other thing how much more toxicity, not only from a research point of view, but actually from a patient care point of view, it can be really hard to sort out.